Welcome to Victory Over Communism with Bill Gertz, the only program willing to pull back the curtain of communism to reveal how China and even America's own brand of Marxism pose real threats to freedom and democracy in America and the world today. Your host and guide to victory over communism is one of the nation's most experienced national security journalists, Bill Gertz, who uses unique facts, pinpoint analysis, and exclusive interviews to identify and counter today's destructive communist ideologies. Now, Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz.
Welcome to the program. By way of introduction, the VOC podcast is about ideology, Chinese communism, and American Marxism. This episode is a deep dive on the revival of Marxism-Leninism under Chinese Supreme Leader Xi Jinping. As I like to emphasize, the VOC podcast is not about people, it's about ideology. In our system, people are free to believe in whatever they like. The goal of the podcast is to educate people to the false ideas behind Marxism-Leninism, and then to offer a counterproposal based on Judeo-Christian concepts that I firmly believe will ultimately address the problems communism has promised but failed to solve. I've been dealing with what I call the China threat for more than 20 years, and that's given me a rich background. I want to share what I've learned over the years about Chinese communist ideology. By doing so, I want to help you understand the danger. I wrote my book, The China Threat, in 2000, and I updated it in 2019 with Deceiving the Sky, Inside Communist China's Drive for Global Supremacy. Many years ago, I knew a great guy named Fred Schwartz. Fred was a founder of a group called the Christian Anti-Communist Crusade. I once hosted Fred at a speech on the campus of the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis, where he spoke to a group of students. Fred wrote an excellent book called You Can Trust a Communist to Be Communist. Its main point is that if you carefully read and listen to what Marxist-Leninists are saying, you can understand clearly their goals and objectives. This remains true today. There is another truth about Chinese communists that is not well understood in the West. That is the fact that Marxist-Leninists are committed revolutionaries who understand the dynamics of political power, and in pursuit of it, will use lies and deception to advance their cause. The reason for that is simple. Marxism-Leninism is based on false understandings about human nature, social systems, and the root cause of strife in the world. For communists, everything is about power, raw power, how to win it, and how to hold it. So, on the one hand, you can learn what Chinese communists, as well as American Marxists, are doing by studying what they say and write about the ideology that drives their action. Many people today are part of what I call the anti-anti-communist camp. Whether they are communists, Marxists, socialists, or none of the above, they falsely believe that those who oppose communism are worse than communists. Yeah, this is a sad state of political discourse today. It's important to remember, as communist revolutionary Leon Trotsky argued before he was killed by Stalin's assassins, communists see two types of morality, theirs and ours. Trotsky also said, for revolutionaries, the end justifies the means as long as it enhances the power of a small group, that is, the vanguard of the proletariat, for whom seizing power from what they falsely view as the source of all evil, the system of capitalism. Trotsky also said there were limits to what communists could do in pursuit of revolution. Yet, in 1918, Vladimir Lenin, in power a few years, made clear there were no limits when he unleashed what was called the Red Terror against his political opponents in Russia in solidifying power. He liquidated an estimate 250,000 political figures in the process. And the crimes were carried out by the CK, the political police and security service that later became the KGB, sword and shield of the Communist Party. Once in power in China, the Chinese Communist Party moved quickly to impose its variant of Red Terror using the Ministry of State Security as its version of the KGB. This modern-day KGB is the true foundation for the emerging totalitarian system in China. Its primary task is not protecting state interests, as its name implies, but solely as the tool to keep the despised Chinese Communist Party in power by any means necessary and at any cost. The other imperative in the ideological war against communism is the vital need to understand clearly communists' use of strategic lies and deception. Recently, I wrote an article for the Washington Times that addresses the subject. It looked back at the historical defector wars inside the Central Intelligence Agency and its Cold War counterintelligence chief, James Angleton. It was Angleton who understood the threat from Soviet communism and who learned details of its use of strategic deception from a defector named Anatoly Golitsyn. That defector set off a major controversy over another defector, Yuri Nosenko, who Angleton and his team of counter-spies believed was dispatched by Moscow specifically to mislead U.S. intelligence regarding presidential assassin Lee Harvey Oswald. The defector's battle is history and produced a severe weakening of CIA counterintelligence. But the important lesson from Angleton is the strategic use by communist states of deception as a weapon in a war against the capitalist West. China's Communist Party is the most active participant in this war, and like its Soviet predecessor, is engaged in the extensive use of strategic deception toward the West. The goal is to hide its true goals and objectives for destroying the capitalist West and dominating the world in the name of the false ideology of Marxism-Leninism. The main effect has been to sow confusion and division within the West about CCP goals and intentions. Like the Soviet Union, the use of strategic deception by Beijing is rooted in Marxism-Leninism, the ideology that allows all communists to lie, cheat, and deceive so long as it is aligned with and achieves the ultimate goal of producing a world dominated under the false religion of communism. It's only through a founding in traditional truth, real truth, and morality that the false ideology of Chinese communism can be decoded. This is the mission of the VOC podcast. Today, both truth and morality are under ideological assault globally to redefine reality to fit its drive to overthrow Western democratic values and freedom and to expand their power ultimately to dominate the world. As I've noted in earlier podcasts, this is not a theoretical danger. It is a real and existential threat that needs to be clearly studied and defeated from an ideological standpoint. In this episode, I'm going to drill down on Chinese communist ideology under current Supreme Leader Xi Jinping. Xi is a hardline communist who speaks of rejuvenation, people's interest, democracy, common prosperity in China and the world as the mission of the CCP. They are all false talking points. What he is really talking about is the rejuvenation of the hated Chinese Communist Party, not people's interests, but the interests of the CCP, not Western-style democracy, but dictatorship of the proletariat and ruthless one-party rule by the CCP. Common prosperity is also a false narrative for the Chinese communists, as common prosperity is defined solely as the prosperity of the CCP and its leaders. My starting point for a clear understanding of Chinese communism under Xi Jinping was disclosed in 2018. The ideology journal Caoxi, the weekly publication of the CCP Central Party School, the most senior communist ideological institution, provided a lengthy explanation of the latest variant of Chinese communist ideology. For the party's 94 million members, all are forced to read tracts and publications like Caoxi and the latest variant of Marxism-Leninism called Xi Jinping Thought on Socialism with Chinese Characteristics for the New Era. The CCP regards this thought as a new stage of development of scientific socialism. That's the euphemism for communism. Use of the term scientific here is code for its atheistic nature, as is the terms dialectical materialism and historical materialism that communists also use to denote their ideology is built on a denial of God. Since 2012, China under Xi now refers to its ideology as the Chinaization of Marxism. What's that? The Chinaization of Marxism in reality means communist China, as part of reform and opening up, rejected Marxist economic theories for one simple reason. They do not work. Worse, Marxist economics designed to destroy capitalism produces widespread economic failures, poverty, social dislocation, wherever they have been implemented in the past. To rescue the failed ideology, the CCP rejected Marxist economics in the 1970s, but not before Communist China founder Mao Zedong nearly destroyed the nation through his personality cult of totalitarian programs like the Great Leap Forward, the Cultural Revolution, and other failed mass campaigns. The programs led directly to the deaths of tens of millions of Chinese who died from forced government failure, famines, Marxist-inspired extermination campaigns, and class warfare elimination programs involving both execution and imprisonment in concentration camps. The most recent campaign is being waged against ethnic Uyghurs in western China, where up to 2 million are languishing in concentration camps dubbed re-education centers by the CCP. The retrenchment was described not as a result of ideological failures, but merely the application of Chinese characteristics to communist ideology. In reality, the period called reform and opening up was the partial imposition of the communists' most violently hated system, capitalism. All China's progress since the 80s to now in producing the world's second largest economy resulted from allowing capitalist economics to flourish while maintaining Marxism-Leninism political and police controls. The Cao Xi article explained that adopting Marxist-Leninist capitalism in China was extremely great and far-reaching in significance toward the rejuvenation of the Chinese nation. The communists in Beijing also assert that their brand of communism is, quote, a great and important landmark event in the history of development of Marxism and in the history of development of socialism in the world. Xi's doctrine is, again, Xi Jinping thought with socialism for socialism with Chinese characteristics for a new era. Semantically, though, never forget that for China's communists, as well as for other revolutionary Marxists around the world, socialism is not an end in itself. It is a stepping stone for history's inevitable march toward world communism. China now declares that its version of communism, and not the Soviet model that collapsed in 91, henceforth is the sole version of communist ideology that will ultimately seek to impose, through force or non-kinetic means, on the entire world. Cao Xi quotes Xi as telling party members that for the party to remain in power as a Marxist governing political party, it must always be really up to the mark. What does that mean? It means ruthless, quote, self-revolution. This is code for purging, neutralizing, and eliminating all who oppose the CCP's power and efforts to expand it. Think back to Lenin's Red Terror. The party must turn the blade of the broadsword inward, dare to scratch any poison in its bone, and dare to cut off a poisoned wrist to save itself if necessary. This, we are told, is part of Chinese communist ideology that, quote, sparkles with the radiance of the truth of Marxism, according to the journal. In the weeds of CCP ideology, there are several numbered euphemisms that cloak the ideology. For example, there are Xi's idea of the eight make clears, that is, eight make clears, considered the most crucial element of the ideology under Xi. What are they? I'm going to go through them fast. Make clear the general task of developing socialism with Chinese characteristics. Make clear the principal social contradiction of our country. This is world capitalism as the enemy of communism. And make clear the overall layout of the cause of socialism with Chinese characteristics. This is the step-by-step plan for the world domination. Also, they want to make clear the general objective of deepening reform. This is really expanding the power of Chinese communism against what the CCP regards as the nihilism of its enemies' ideologies. They also want to make clear the general goal of governing the country according to law. This is really a false notion. In China, there's no governance by law. The governance by CCP diktat exists, where the ends justify the mean. They also want to make clear the goal of strengthening the army. This is a result of Mao's dictum that political power grows from the barrel of a gun. Also, the communists are making clear the diplomacy of a big country with Chinese characteristics. That's the CCP interprets that as global subservience to the party. All states must bow down to Beijing. And eight, they must make clear the most essential characteristics of socialism with Chinese characteristics. Again, using lies and deception to fool foreign opponents about Beijing's real goals and ideological objectives. I won't continue with the next buzz phrase, which is called the 14 adheres. Its content is, again, more lies and deception about things like regarding people as the center and comprehensively deepening reform and adhering to harmonious coexistence between humans and nature. Again, China is the most polluted nation on Earth and is rapidly destroying the environment. According to Chao Shi, the 14 adheres are the basic strategies for upholding and developing socialism with Chinese characteristics in the new era. Intrinsic to these are the world outlook and methodology of dialectical materialism and historical materialism. I revealed how dialectical materialism is a false communist tenet in the last podcast. Dialectical materialism is based on conflict. As discussed, though, progress grows not from conflict, but cooperation that is fundamental to progress. Historical materialism is the false notion that communism is magically evolving the world into an ideal workers' paradise. In reality, the history of Marxism-Leninism has been a history of inhuman hatred, tyranny, suffering, and death. Again, the estimates range between 60 million to 100 million deaths from communism in China alone. Next to come under the new ideology are the four comprehensives. This is a strategic layout to building a so-called well-off society, but it's actually one ruled by the CCP with no vestige of opposition or pro-democracy elements. They also talk about deepening reform and comprehensive administrative of party. That is destroying all party elements not aligned with Xi's dictatorship. As I noted, the CCP couches its ideology in the flowery but deceptive language of protecting the people, seeking their happiness, protecting the environment, and ruling by law. These are all communist lies. The CCP has no interest in such ideals. It remains a ruthless Marxist-Leninist organization with the goal of preserving and expanding its power and ideology throughout the world at any cost. As Xi Jinping said, quote, "The basic principles of scientific socialism cannot be abandoned. Otherwise, it will no longer be socialism. Besides, scientific socialism is never a fixed, unchangeable religious doctrine." End quote. Here again, the replacement of religion by communism makes clear it is not merely world capitalism led by the United States that is the Chinese Communist Party's main enemy, but the entirety of Judeo-Christian civilization that must be replaced. The CCP's ideological war is fundamental and unchanging. Noting capitalist adjustments in the West, the Chao Shi Journal states that no matter what readjustment capitalism may make, the basic contradictions of capitalism will not change. They believe that's the nature of capitalism, of chasing profits, will not change. The value principles of individualism and egoism will not change. They want total state control. And the status of being oppressed and exploited of the working class will not change, according to Chao Shi. For the communists, destroying capitalism is the ultimate goal in pursuit of the false concept of eliminating exploitation and realizing social equality, a term we hear among American Marxists. Even realizing freedom and comprehensive development of each person is, created the new communist human, part of the objective. Ultimately, Chinese communist ideology seeks the emancipation of humankind. the CCP Journal said, cultural and historical traditions of individual nations can easily be integrated with China's Marxism-Leninism. Thus, it will be possible to turn a blueprint into a magnificent reality. To achieve its objectives, the communist ideology in China also includes something called the four awarenesses. That's political awareness of the core, alignment, commitment to communist goals, and overall and awareness of the overall situation, which is understanding enemies. The reality of Chinese communists today is that the ideology so intrinsic to Xi Jinping's rule is bankrupt. It carries no real weight. Cracks in the edifice of Chinese communism are everywhere. Protests against the COVID restrictions and outbreaks of civil unrest, and protesters no longer avoid singling out Xi and his CCP. There's some hopeful signs. In his latest New Year's address, Xi made no calls for following his thought on socialism with Chinese characteristics. In fact, from the speech, the supreme leader appeared weakened. He was very defensive. That's the result of badly mishandling the zero COVID policies that produced widespread economic dislocation and, more importantly, widespread anger at the ruling Chinese Communist Party. While it's difficult to tell the strength of his grip on power, these indicators point to a dictator who may well be in jeopardy. I'll be right back after a short break.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters. Stand by for more after these important messages.
Hi, this is Bill Gertz. I wanted to talk to you briefly about my latest book. It's called Deceiving the Sky: Inside Communist China's Drive for Global Supremacy. This is the most important book you can read to fully understand the threat posed by the Chinese Communist government. I urge you to get a copy today. It can be found at my website, The Gertz File. That's GertzFile.com, or at the book site called DeceivingTheSky.com.
If you enjoy listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz, please consider helping Bill with his important work of educating patriots just like you about how communism is very real and even more dangerous than ever before. Your donation to the Victory Over Communism program will help expand its reach across America and throughout the world. In fact, you'll be helping to provide the kind of information that may well make its way behind the new Iron Curtain and the Great Firewall of China and inspire those living under communism to seek freedom. Supporting the Victory Over Communism program is easy. Just visit the program website, victoryovercommunism.net, and click on the link at the bottom to GoFundMe.com. Again, just visit victoryovercommunism.net and click on the link to GoFundMe.com. Thanks for listening, and God bless America.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back. This is the counterproposal section, or what I call the spiritual segment. It is based on the teachings of the late Reverend Sun Myung-moon, who learned firsthand the terror of communism during imprisonment and his survival at a North Korean death camp near Hungnam. The counterproposal was developed in the 1980s during the Cold War as a way to neutralize Soviet communism ideologically. I've adapted what I call the VOC worldview to the current dual threats of Chinese communism and American Marxism. Earlier, I discussed the false communist doctrine of dialectical materialism. In this section, I address another fundamental but mistaken element of Marxism, historical materialism. This is the concept that argues history is advancing toward communism in accord with the dialectics, sometimes described as a process of struggle or thesis, antithesis, synthesis. This is why Nikita Khrushchev confidently proclaimed in 1958, "We will bury you, and history is on our side." Likewise, current Chinese leader Xi Jinping has proclaimed his variant of Chinese communism as the leading ideology of both socialism and progressivism in the world. For communists, all societies are inevitably heading toward communism. The VOC worldview shows the fallacy of this by contrasting Marxist theory of history with the view of God-affirming people that maintains God ultimately governs history through his providence. However, our science-oriented age has become dominated at all levels by people who doubt the validity of this statement. Our problem-ridden world today is viewed by more and more people who feel God does not exist, or worse, he seems to be dead, or he seems to be helpless in terms of human affairs. Let's discuss two crucial questions. As I stated in earlier podcasts, God's purpose clearly is to create a world of good. Instead, we see a world of evil. The Bible provides assurances that God will restore this evil world to goodness. Still, there are two crucial questions that demand answers. First, how is it that God's good world became evil? This has challenged many people. Bertrand Russell, Albert Camus, and others observed the world around them and saw so much suffering, so much evil, and so much wrongdoing, they came to the conclusion there could not be a God. If a good God exists, how could he allow the continuation of such suffering? How could he have allowed this world to become evil in the first place? This dilemma has led some to conclude there's no God. A second question that needs an answer is this. If God does exist and does want to stop human suffering and restore the world to a status of goodness, why is it taking him so long? People are tired of waiting. Attempts to solve the confusion produced various explanations. One is the God is dead theology. This view emerged from very strongly in the 1960s through theologians such as Thomas Altzer and William Hamilton. According to this view, the traditional understanding of God had to be reevaluated. This view particularly challenged the role of God as a parent and problem solver. For them, God had given humans freedom and dominion over the earth. It is humankind's role to accept responsibility for our lives in the world. Likewise, other radical positions came out, such as liberation theology and Christian Marxism. They challenged the traditional view of God and emphasized that humans play the pivotal role in bringing about social change. In the case of Russia, it was communism that took God's place. In communist China, the same is true. As I noted earlier, Xi Jinping's communist ideology calls itself the great and important landmark event in the history of the development of Marxism and in the history of development of socialism in the world. Chinese communists frequently use the word spiritual in discussing the benefits of their ideology. Communism seemingly solves the dilemma of human suffering. Belief in God, according to communist ideology, prevents understanding the real source of evil, division of labor by class. Once class relations are ended, communists claim evil will disappear. For communism, there is no God. History moves according to the laws of nature, which are dialectical. This is the view of historical materialism. Although historical materialism has been critiqued very well by free world thinkers, it nonetheless continues to gain new adherents. The VOC worldview approaches this problem from the ground floor. Historical materialism is based on dialectical materialism, which again is based on the denial of God. The foundation is false. Historical materialism is like a castle built on sand that will be washed away by the flood. Nevertheless, a critique of historical materialism alone is not sufficient. A view of history must be set forth which convincingly explains the patterns of history from a God-affirming point of view. This is one of the unique and powerful elements of the VOC worldview in exposing the fallacies of communism. Next, let's discuss free will and responsibility. Traditionally, Christianity taught that God endowed humans with free will. Frequently, however, the full implications of this belief are not fully understood, or not understood clearly. In the opening passages of the Bible, it's written that God told Adam and Eve, "You may freely eat of every tree in the garden, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat. For the day that you eat of it, you shall die." This passage, whether it is taken literally or not, has profound meaning. God gave a commandment, and he warned his children that if they fail to abide by it, the consequence will be death. The first option is obedience to God's word. By inference, the conclusion is that through obedience, Adam and Eve shall have life. The second option is disobedience to God's commandment, and the consequence of that disobedience is separation from God or spiritual death. That would be the opposite of God's will. What determines whether humans go the way of good or the way of evil Ultimately, it is humans themselves. Humankind is given the right to make decisions that will affect their eternal life. In the spiritual sense, this is a tremendous freedom. Obviously, when the first ancestors disobeyed God, the result was spiritual death, and this obviously affected human history. Freedom is a privilege that carries with it great responsibility. The abuse of freedom brings the destruction of life. The Bible contains many passages that clearly show history is not shaped by God alone. For example, Genesis 6:6 reads, "And the Lord was sorry that he had made man from the earth, and it grieved him to his heart." Clearly, humankind is responsible for things that happen against God's will. In Exodus 32, verses 7 to 14, God declares his intention to have his wrath burn hot against the Israelites for building the golden calf. Moses pleads with God, however, and finally we read that the Lord repented of the evil which he thought to do his people. In Isaiah 38, God announces through Isaiah that he will take the life of King Hezekiah. But after Hezekiah's prayer, God says, "I have heard thy prayer, I have seen thy fears. Behold, I will add unto thy days 15 years. These and other biblical examples attest that history is shaped by the interplay between God's will and humankind's free response to God. Unlike other creatures, God created humans with free will. Humankind's responsibility, then, is to cooperate with God to achieve his own growth and maturity, as well as the perfection of the universe. The tragedy of history is that humans failed to cooperate with God. Humankind violated the law and went against the will of God and unwittingly took the road of spiritual death. Thus, tragedy occurred in human history, and tragic consequences have been continuously suffered by all humankind. So why did God create humans with free will? At this point, the most significant and vital question to ask God is this: God, why didn't you save yourself a great deal of trouble? You actually invited the problem. If you had made humans like any other creature incapable of violating your principle, you would not have suffered the consequences of the human fall. Giving humans free will has caused all of your problems. It's a powerful question. Is it possible God was unaware of the outcome? Nope. He knew that if he gave humans free will, there would be a possibility of the fall of humankind. Then why was he obliged to give humans free will? There must be some compelling reason why God must give us free will. And basically, there's three reasons for this. God is a being of love, and he created humans for love. Humankind, therefore, could not be created as a robot or a machine. A person has a mind and is not programmed. A person has a spirit. A person is capable of virtue, love, and creativity. These qualities stem from freedom and allow us to become godlike. God can only find real joy in a being that responds freely to his personal volition. God has a choice in creation. He can either create a free human being, or he can create something else which lacks free will, like a robot. Clearly, God wanted to create free men and women, not robots. It is free will that distinguishes humans from robots and from any other aspect of creation. It would be pointless to create human beings without giving them free will. Specifically, the VOC worldview lists three reasons for God choosing to give this free will to humans. First, he wanted humans to be co-creators. God did not want to have the human race be just another animal species or robot. The loving heart of God longed for children. God therefore wanted men and women to be like himself as his total image. Certainly, the power of creativity is among the greatest characteristics of God. God wanted humans to share this power of creation and to become co-creators with God. God made humans with the potential for perfection rather than as a finished product. In the process, he completed 95%, figuratively, and then gave humankind 5% responsibility to create the rest of himself. 100% represents the perfection of humans. When perfection is achieved by this formula, the result is a joint effort of both God and humans. God created 95%, and humans must create 5% of their being. In this respect, humans are elevated to the level of a creator. In order to become a co-creator with God, humans were given a 5% responsibility that must be fulfilled through their own free will. Otherwise, the purpose of creation would be left unfulfilled. Let me illustrate with an analogy. Let's say God is building a wall and there are 100 bricks to lay to complete it. God has laid 95 bricks and asks his son to lay the last 5 bricks to finish the wall. The son responds to God and lays the last 5 bricks to perfection. A beautiful wall is thus completed, and God turns to his son and pats him on the shoulder, praising him, saying, "My son, it is a job well done. This wall is a joint venture between you and me. You and I are both creators of this world." God wants to give this kind of credit to humans. He wants to see the honor of co-creationship bestowed upon humans so that humans, as children of God, can share in the creativity of God. What has happened is that humankind dropped the bricks and did not finish the wall. God is certainly capable of saying to his son, "My son, you're having some difficulty, so let me do it." But if God did that, at that moment, humans would lose the potential to become co-creators and could no longer become true children of God, reflecting his perfect image. That's why God has not taken over humans' duty, but is instead always urging humans to fulfill their responsibility in history. God is like the greatest high school football coach. The coach will do everything possible to teach and inspire the team. He'll push them, give them pep talks, scold them, etc. The only thing the coach can't do is go onto the field and play the game for him. If he does, they are no longer players. The coach becomes the player and the game is meaningless. Similarly, God can do so much, but he can't take over humankind's responsibility without taking away humans' free will. And that would nullify humans' unique position as God's children, turning them into a machine or a robot. Tragically, human history has been a record of many failures of humankind. It was not God that failed. It has always been humans that failed God. Still, God must be patient and wait until one day when humans fulfill their responsibility. Humans always have the final word because faith must be exercised voluntarily. This is a unique and new way of understanding the anguish of God. He is still waiting for humans to come forward and carry the ball into the end zone. It might take tens of thousands of years, but God always has hope, because once the game is won, it can never be reversed. Once humans reach perfection, they will remain perfected forever, and that's a worthwhile wait. So, if someone is ignorant of this law, that is something that could make it very easy for them to deny God. Communism could only come into being because ignorance of humans' portion of responsibility. Communist doctrine says there's no God, but ironically, it is only because God has given freedom to humankind that communism is possible. There is only one way to end communism. That will be when humans fully understand God's principles and laws and fulfill his desire by totally fulfilling their 5% responsibility. The full potential of humankind is realized by uniting completely with God and making the living God triumphant and real in each person's heart. This is our sacred responsibility. Humans are children of God. God is a free being and is our Father. We are created in the image of God. Clearly, a child should reflect the total image of his parent, God, the Father, and has free will. Therefore, his sons and daughters must also have free will. God has responsibility. Therefore, men and women must share the responsibility. In the ideal of God's creation, every person would live as a child of God. The nature and characteristics of these children must be identical to those of God. God is a free being, therefore humankind must be free. Endowed with remarkable gifts of free will and creativity, men and women must be called the second selves of God. Also, in the context of God's history, love must be voluntary. This is another important reason God endowed humans with free will. It's so that God wants to achieve his purpose of creation in the voluntary give and take of love with humans. You can't force someone to love you. Love must be exercised in freedom. Love by coercion is no longer love, it's slavery. That is an essential characteristic of love. Only by experiencing voluntary love coming freely from his children can God achieve joy and satisfaction. An example is my Apple Watch. I'm very fond of it. It acts as a phone if I leave my cell phone behind. It backs up my phone for messages. It sends me alerts when I need them. And it also keeps pretty good time. Yet my appreciation for the watch is limited. I take for granted that the watch will help me and keep good time. It's set to do so and has no free will to do otherwise. The watch performs according to the programs and apps created by Apple. No one says thank you every day to their watch. On the other hand, the relationship between parents and children is totally different. There's no limit to the depth of love and appreciation in this relationship. If the parents come back from a trip and their child is waiting at the airport, how do they feel? What if the child has even saved his allowance without buying things and bought them flowers? They will be overjoyed. They will undoubtedly kiss their child, and they may even shed tears. Why is that? Because it is a little deed of love and comes from the exercise of free will by the child. By the same token, God is giving his entire love to humankind through his free will. God, in turn, longs for humankind to freely return love to God. That love alone can give God joy and satisfaction. God does not want to receive love any other way, and for this reason, God created humans with total free will. Our human responsibility is to understand God and freely respond to his love. I'm going to continue this segment on the counterproposal to historical materialism in the next podcast. I'll elaborate on how human failure has prolonged God's history, which is a history of restoring humans back to the original state before their separation of God through human failure. And this produced the current evil-dominated world. I'm also going to talk about the three steps in the process of restoring God's ideal. Find God not only intellectually and philosophically, but in a deeper, artistic way. Second, humans need to know God's will. And third, humankind needs faith and obedience to God's will. All are the 5% of human responsibility. I'll be right back after a short break.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters.
Welcome back. This is the news section where I address a topic related to communist ideology in the news. As I mentioned, I recently wrote a piece in the Washington Times on how the CIA struggled with its internal battle over how to confront and counter Soviet communism. My usual disclaimer here, the VOC podcast is a freelance project and does not necessarily represent the views of my news outlet, the Washington Times. In research for the story, I looked into a remarkable book by the late human rights activist and democratic dissident who opposed the Soviet Union. That's Vladimir Bukovsky. In his book in English, Judgment in Moscow, published a short time before his death in 2019, Bukovsky discussed the end of the Soviet Union in the late 1980s and how it divided pro-democracy dissidents who fought, and many of whom died, against the massive communist police state. Bukovsky said his opposition to communism during this period was dismissed by some of his critics who said he had suffered too much and thus wasn't objective. What could I answer, he said. How is it possible to explain to people who have never lived under this regime that communism is not a political system and not even so much a crime as a sort of mass illness, like an epidemic of the plague? It is impossible to take offense at the plague. One can neither quarrel nor make amends with it. One can only become infected or not. Consequently, there's no chance of reconstructing or reforming the plague. One must strive to recover from it, straining every sinew of the will to live. As a rule, the ones who did not try to fight and who sank into apathy didn't survive. In the West, Bukovsky lamented, the thoughtless euphoria over communist reformer Gorbachev said it undermined the last chance of victory over communism. At the same time, it also scuttled the smallest hope for Russia's recovery, a prophetic statement considering the current KGB state in Russia under Putin. Bukowski said the condition of the late Soviet Union was as if the Allies at the end of the Second World War had not demanded the unconditional capitulation of Nazi Germany, but contented themselves instead with perestroika, namely a certain liberalization of the Nazi regime. Bukowski makes a point that there would be no democracy in Europe. And similarly, without a similar ending of communism completely, the result was catastrophic. It was a failure to gain an unconditional condemnation of communism that's contributed to the schism among the democratic world today. Bukowski noted at the time that a former political prisoner and priest, Gleb Yakunin, was fooled into voting for an ex-KGB general for public office, Oleg Kalugin, who had been an organizer of killing dissidents in the past. In his view, how is it possible to determine who is a real Democrat and who is one of Gorbachev's adherents? He said he never forget how the opening of the puppet parliament in the spring of 1989, Gorbachev made the grand gesture of inviting noted dissident Andrei Sakharov to step up to the podium, thereby covering up all the lies, all the manipulations, and falsifications of the dying Soviet regime. Early last month, a more contemporary dissident from communism, this time from China, provided another powerful exposé of the Chinese Communist Party under Xi Jinping. This remarkable defector from Chinese communism is a woman named Tsai Xu. She's a former professor at the Central Party School of the Chinese Communist Party, and where she worked from 1998 to 2012. She defected to the United States in 2019. Her article appeared in the prestigious highbrow journal Foreign Affairs under the provocative headline, "The Party That Failed." Tsai at one time had hope for China becoming a normal, non-communist state after Xi Jinping came to power in 2012. She said, "I knew enough about history to conclude that it was past time for China to open up its political system. After a decade of stagnation, the CCP needed reform more than ever, and Xi, who had hinted at his proclivity for change, seemed like the man to lead it." By then, Tsai had been midway through a decades-long process of grappling with the fallacies of China's official ideology, even as she was responsible for indoctrinating all the top officials. Once a fervent Marxist, she parted ways with Marxism and increasingly looked to Western thought for answers to China's problems. Once a proud defender of official policy, she began questioning the ideology and making the case for liberalization. A loyal CCP member, she secretly harbored fundamental doubts about the sincerity of its belief and its concern for the Chinese people. Tsai was not surprised when she shifted to hardline Marxism-Leninism and opposed all political reform. She spoke out and knew it was no longer safe for her to be in China. As Xi Jinping gradually took power and through his tenure, the Chinese regime in Beijing generated further into a political oligarchy bent on holding on to power through brutality and ruthlessness. It grew even more repressive and dictatorial. It's now a personality cult that surrounds him, and he's tightened the party's grip on ideology and eliminated what little space there was for political speech and civil society. People who don't live in mainland China, and for the past 8 years, could not understand how brutal the regime has become or how many tragedies it's authored, according to Tsai. As a CCP princeling, that is an offspring of a communist military family whose grandfather joined Mao, Tsai grew up in relative wealth in a revolutionary family. The ease of life fooled her into seeing China's socialism as having a bright future. She was allowed to read ideology books, and she was filled with reverence, she said, even though she failed to understand the false nature of the ideological arguments the books contained. The comment highlights again the quasi-religious nature of communism. "My mission was clear," she said. "I must love the motherland, inherit my parents' revolutionary legacy, and build a communist society free of exploitation. I was a true believer." She then joined the communist military, the People's Liberation Army, in 1969, during the disastrous Cultural Revolution, when everyone was required to read six works by Marx and the Communist Manifesto. At a PLA library she managed, Tsai read prohibited works by so-called reactionaries. They were only open to communists who needed to read them in order to study China's ideological enemies. Her exposure to the world of ideas outside communism had a big influence and surprised her. Still, she maintained her belief in Marxism as the only truth. During reforms put in place after Mao's death in 76, Tsai joined a local party governing order and was allowed to read other Marxist works, including Das Kapital. She noted that she was impressed with Marxist philosophy and its emphasis on dialectical materialism, as we noted, a major false precept of Marxism. She eventually joined the faculty at the Central Party School, the heart of communist ideological indoctrination, that trained generations of communists, including all those now in the most senior positions of power. Xi Jinping headed the school from 2007 until 2012, when he became the supreme leader. The 1989 Tiananmen massacre was a turning point for Tsai, and she was appalled at the CCP use of troops to kill unarmed pro-democracy protesters. The protests, combined with the fall of communism in Russia and Europe, prompted the CCP to launch a major campaign to counteract what it regarded as ideological laxity. It included mass indoctrination at the party school. For her zealotry at the party school, Tsai's colleagues referred to her as old Mrs. Marx. For her, teaching Marxism at the school became more and more difficult. The reason? It was clear to most students, communist ideology is false or unworkable. Most of the questions revolved around puzzling contradictions within the official ideology that, again, as we noted, had been modified to justify real-world policies implemented by the CCP. For example, in 2004, China's constitution said that government protects human rights and private property. But a core view of Marx is that communist systems must abolish private property. Deng Xiaoping who bent the ideology with his "let a part of the population get rich first," or "it's glorious to be rich." This was a tool to motivate people and stimulate productivity. This too contradicted the central Marxian tenet that communism provides each according to his needs. The contradictions mounted and led Tsai to question her belief in communism. She then began compromising by embracing a kind of Marxist humanist view, and what she regarded as the Marxists who stress freedom, like in the West, like Antonio Gramsci and Herbert Marcuse. Tsai quietly began advocating for further reform in China, such as allowing private companies to compete and blaming rampant corruption on government control of the economy. Her views found support from Deng Xiaoping's successor, that was Jiang Zemin, who stimulated private enterprise, further undermining CCP theories of planned economy and national self-sufficiency. Since the ideology of neither Marxism, Mao, or Deng failed to resolve the ideological contradictions, Jiang made up a new retrenchment from the ideology, and again, using the numerology, called it the Three Represents. Tsai viewed them as a significant shift in communist ideology. She believed Jiang's modified communism abandoned the core Marxist belief that capitalists were an exploitative social group. Instead, Jiang opened the party to capitalists, something that she supported. Ideological debate ensued. Communist leftists in China opposed the shift, arguing it went too far. To placate the leftists, Chinese propaganda, which has a major control over promoting ideology, supported the shift and interposed it with references to Marx, Engels, Lenin, Stalin, Mao, and Deng. Tsai said she opposed the adulteration of the reform effort. The Three Represents were hollow if they restated existing communist ideology. "I was disgusted by the superficial methods of the party's publicity apparatus," she said. "I grew determined to reveal the true meaning of the Three Represents, a theory that in fact marked a bold departure for China. This, it turned out, would bring me into conflict with the entrenched bureaucracy of the CCP." She would further grow pessimistic toward the CCP ability to conduct political reform. The party came to power in 1949 through violence and was deeply wedded to the idea that it had earned the permanent monopoly on political power. The party's record, particularly the crackdown on Tiananmen Square, demonstrated it's not going to give up its monopoly on power peacefully. And none of the post-Deng Xiaoping leaders had the courage to push for political reform. They simply wanted to pass the buck to future leaders. Moreover, the highly centralized, oppressive version of Marxism embraced by the CCP owed more to Stalin than to Marx. It's an ideology built to serve a self-interested dictatorship. Marxism should not be worshipped as an absolute truth, and China had to start the journey to democracy, according to Tsai. But Jiang's successor, Hu Jintao, moved in the opposite direction. Hu Jintao put forward the scientific outlook on development as his personal calling card and substitute for the three represents. It was another attempt to justify China's mixed development model with a thin cover of Marxist-sounding ideology. The number of petitioners seeking redress from government increased dramatically, and nationwide there were demonstrations that eventually exceeded some 100,000 demonstrations a year. These were small-scale operations, but demonstrations nonetheless. Tsai said, "To me, the discontent showed that it was becoming harder for China to develop its economy without liberalizing its politics. So China under Hu Jintao entered a period of political stagnation, a decline similar to what the Soviet Union experienced under Leonid Brezhnev." That led Tsai to hope that Xi Jinping would be a Chinese Gorbachev-style reformer. She left the party school in 2012 and watched Xi Jinping closely to see if the ideology would turn left or right on the ideological spectrum. She was told by one of her party school colleagues, "It's not a question of whether Xi is going left or right, but that he lacks judgment and speaks illogically." Xi Jinping's plan after 2013 lacked political reform, making clear he was a committed Marxist-Leninist. He launched the biggest ideological campaign since Mao's death to revive Maoist rule. The plan called for intensified societal surveillance and a crackdown on the limited free expression that was allowed to flourish. There was a ban on any discussion of constitutional democracy and universal values, and this was shamelessly promoted under the deceptions of governance, management, service, and law. The CCP political regression was in full swing. By 2015, the party had rounded up hundreds of defense lawyers as part of the crackdown on any dissidents. A year later, it launched a cultural revolution-style campaign against an outspoken real estate tycoon known as Ren Zhengzhang, an outspoken party member with millions of social media followers. He was labeled anti-party and eventually made a non-person and slapped with an 18-year prison term, communist rule by imprisonment. Tsai protested on WeChat, and her post went viral, simply quoting the CCP constitution and code of conduct. She was accused of serious errors that produced interrogations and psychological pressure to prompt a false confession of wrongdoing. "I recognize the process as a psychological contest," she said. "If I didn't show fear, I realized they would lose half the battle." Ministry of State Security surveillance continued, and then a major event was the publication of a speech he gave in February 2016 that said communist ideology violates common sense and deteriorates into lies. This led to further CCP accusations of her opposing Xi Jinping himself, a cardinal sin in the system. Threats to keep silent followed. CCP officials threatened the humiliating prospect of holding a large public meeting and denouncing her in formal punishment. Each interrogation was followed by a demand that they be kept secret. As Tsai said, it was all part of an underworld that couldn't be exposed to the light of day. The framing of an environmentalist who would die in police custody was her final break with the party. "After 20 years of hesitation, confusion, and misery, I made the decision to emerge from the darkness and make a complete break from the party," she said. Xi's great leap backwards soon left me with no other choice. Tsai traveled to the United States in 2019, and she was told by a friend that if she returned, she would be arrested for anti-party activities. As the pandemic emerged, Tsai was disgusted by Xi's mishandling of the outbreak, and she then signed a petition supporting Li Wenliang, the Wuhan ophthalmologist who has been harassed by police for providing the first warning to friends about the new disease. He eventually died of it. I received urgent phone calls from the authorities at the Central Party School demanding that I come home, Tsai said. Authorities then unearthed a private talk she gave online that referred to the CCP as a political zombie and urging Xi Jinping to step down. An article she wrote denouncing Xi's new repressive national security law was also used against her. I knew I was in trouble. Soon I was expelled from the party. The school stripped me of my retirement benefits. My bank account was frozen. I asked the authorities at the Central Party School for a guarantee of my personal safety if I returned. Officials there avoided answering the question and instead made vague threats against her daughter. It was at this point that she accepted the truth. There was no going back. This remarkable testimony really shows what I was talking about earlier in the podcast about the evil nature of the Chinese Communist Party system. I'll be right back with the interview portion after a short break.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters. Stand by for more after these important messages.
I spoke to you earlier about my book, Deceiving the Sky. I also wanted to urge you to take a look at another book that I wrote called iWar, War and Peace in the Information Age. We live in an information age, and yet we're getting bombarded with enemy propaganda coming at us from all different directions. iWar really helps expose what we need to do and how we need to counter it. I urge you to get a copy. The book can be found at iwarbook.com or at my website, thegertzfile.com.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back. I'm joined on the program now by retired Navy Captain Jim Fennell. Jim, until not too long ago, was Director of Intelligence and Information Operations for the U.S. Pacific Fleet, he's one of the most knowledgeable experts on the China threat. Jim, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bill, it's great to be on your show. Thank you for invitation.
Before we get to questions about U.S. military readiness to deal with the Chinese military, let me ask you about Chinese ideology. Under Xi Jinping, the CCP has moved sharply to restore a kind of neo-Maoism. How does Chinese communism apply? How does this affect the People's Liberation Army, which, again, a lot of people don't understand, isn't really a national army. It's an army of a political party.
Yeah, it is the army of the people, the Chinese Communist Party. But given that the Chinese Communist Party can just take ownership of any organization or company in the country, it in fact is the entire country's army in a way. But it's not the people's army, as it says, the People's Liberation Army. It's the Chinese Communist Party's army. So that I think they should be renamed. But they're getting all the resources that they need. And in fact, over the last two decades, but especially in the last 10 years, they're getting the prioritization of Xi Jinping and the Communist Party's efforts in terms of allocation of resources. So when the Chinese economy starts to tank, like it began in 2012 with the soft landing, and they stopped growing at 10% a year and they started to go down, we were told by all the experts and the economists and the China hands that, well, we'll see the same kind of diminishment in spending on the Chinese military, the PLA. But in fact, the Chinese Liberation Army continued to receive lion's share of the funding. And so while in 2020 and 2021 and 2022, when the Chinese economy was not growing at all or less than 5%, less than 3%, the Chinese PLA continued to grow at 6.6, 6.8, and this year they say 7.1% growth each year. So it's very clear that the Communist Party has said, whatever else happens in this country, we're going to continue to build our military.
Yeah, and I think another factor here is, too, we've seen recently with the COVID lockdowns and the protests against Beijing and its draconian problems, I wonder how this has impacted the PLA. And really, is communist ideology, Chinese communist ideology, which the Chinese are calling Xi Jinping thought on socialism for the new era, is communism a weapon for the PLA, or will it be a hindrance in a future conflict with them? How does their ideology fit within the PLA?
Well, I think within the PLA, it's been an asset. Because they've been able to use the Communist Party as the unifying force to bring everybody together. And essentially under Xi, you know, we had military modernization that began under paramount leader Xi, Jiang Zemin, accelerated under Hu Jintao with the historic missions that they were assigned to do and to go out to the far seas. But it was really under Xi that you started to see this dramatic changes to the PLA, like in 2015 when he cut the size of the PLA from 2.3 million to 2 million. And you're like, well, that doesn't sound so very good. Well, it was, because they got rid of all these people that weren't, as we say in the U.S. side, trigger pullers. So he got rid of all this fat, all this people that weren't involved with combat. And then he reorganized the military regions from 7 military regions to 5 theater commands that are joint commands that are more aligned to the United States unified command structure and our combatant commanders. And then they elevated the Navy and the Air Force and the Strategic Rocket Force, and they created the Strategic Support Force for cyber warfare and electronic warfare. And then they had a Joint Logistics Support Force. This was all done under Xi Jinping's, in the last 10 years that he's been in control. And so because he's the party leader and he can order things, he's been able to bring everybody in the PLA together. And, you know, I haven't talked to a lot of PLA officers, you know, in the last few years, but I was on a frigate in Kiel, Germany in 2019. And the sense of pride, the sense of proficiency and professionalism that I saw from PLA Navy sailors was something I had not seen in my previous 20 years. And I remember a port call I made in Qingdao, China in 2004 on board the USS Cushing. And we had a dinner with the Chinese North Sea Fleet commander, deputy commander, and a bunch of these Chinese naval officers. And I remember one guy told me, he goes, "We have the same pride in Jiang Zemin, what he's done for the buildup of the PLA, like you guys have for Ronald Reagan." And that was 2004. Mm-hmm. And so my assessment is that if the Chinese naval officers took a lot of pride in their leader back in 2004 because of what he did, I can only imagine that the pride and the unity that PLA officers have today under Xi Jinping. And I know that there's people that say that, well, in the country, there's a lot of people that don't respect Xi and the party, and we've seen that in these protests. But my sense is that inside the PLA, especially in the Navy and in the Air Force and the Strategic Rocket Force and these other smaller forces, Support Force and Logistics Force, that they're actually pretty happy about what this guy's done.
Yeah, and he's definitely stepped up the war fighting capabilities. I mean, they said he wants their exercises to be realistic in combat. He's really getting them ready for war, which, let's shift topics and talk about, are we ready to deal with them? Recently, we were told by Secretary of State Antony Blinken that China is speeding up its timetable for taking over Taiwan, Other senior civilian and military officials have echoed the same thing. This tells me that there's some new sense, new information, and a new urgency to addressing the threat of a Taiwan attack. Where does the U.S. military stand today on preparations to deter and then respond and defeat the Chinese if needed?
So I've been since I've retired for the last 7 years, I've been a pretty strong critic of where we're at and thinking that we're not ready and providing warning about the capabilities that the Chinese military has. And what I'd say is in my conversations with people in Hawaii and Washington and watching our force movements is that the people that are in charge today, for the most part, are trying desperately to, be able to deter or defeat the PLA if we got into a conflict. But in many ways, they're like a person that goes to Las Vegas and they're thrown, they're playing poker and they're thrown a set of cards that are just, really poor cards. And they have a couple of twos and threes and they don't have any flushes. They don't have any straights. They don't have anything. And so they're willing to play. They know how to play, but they can't because they don't have the tools that are necessary. And I say the tools necessary because the United States Navy now is not the biggest Navy in the world. And when you split up that our Navy is, or when you consider that our Navy is split up into two forces, one in the Pacific Fleet and one in the Atlantic Fleet, that takes our Navy that's not even the largest and cuts it in half. And then when you take that we have the U.S. 7th Fleet, which is our forward deployed Navy, that substantially hasn't really changed in total numbers of platforms in the last 30, 40 years. And while China's Navy has grown to be the biggest military, you can start to see that we're facing what I use the term overmatch. Mm-hmm. And then when you start adding in that the Chinese have focused their buildup on this counter-intervention strategy or this area, the anti-access area denial, A2AD that we call it, and they've built this array of anti-ship cruise missiles that are launched from submarines, from surface ships, from fighters, from bombers. We have anti-ship ballistic missiles that go outside the atmosphere into space and then come back down to target our big deck aircraft carriers or amphibious carriers. And then we now have this new phenomenon of hypersonic missiles that go faster than 5 times the speed of sound, which is a new technology that our defense systems aren't capable of. And you start adding all these things in and you start to get this feeling that even though we have good people and they're well-intentioned, we're just not there when it comes to the ability to fight. And there something needs to be dramatically or drastically done in Washington. And I'm really worried about that.
Yeah. Last question. And in the short time we have left, what do we need to do? For example, one thing we could do is we need to put another aircraft carrier strike group forward deploy. We have one, the Reagan in Japan. That would be my recommendation. What do we need to do to really bolster our forces in the Pacific against China?
Right. We really need to get away from this 50-50 mindset that 50% in the Pacific, 50% in the Atlantic. We need to go to 70-30. We need to start taking our fleet and move it into the Pacific. We need to start forward deploying more things, as you said. So why don't we put an aircraft carrier, a second one, maybe in Japan or maybe in Guam, maybe in Palau? We need to start putting more submarines forward that have these missiles that can sink this Chinese invasion fleet. And then we need to really start dramatically building up platforms as rapidly as possible that can fire missiles that can sink the Chinese fleet. And that's not just from the Navy, but it can be done from the Marine Corps, as I think there's a lot of thinking about that, and the Air Forces. But we have to really be prepared to destroy the Chinese invasion fleet or the Chinese roaming fleet, the fleet in being, as Mahan called it. Because that Chinese fleet, once they take Taiwan, they're not going to stop at Taiwan. They're going to continue east to Guam, to Hawaii, and to our west coast. And so sooner or later, we're going to have to be able to have the capacity to defeat the Chinese Navy. And we keep everybody in Washington keeps ignoring this threat, and that's the real critical concern.
We've been talking with Jim Fennell. He's a retired Navy captain and former director of the Intelligence and Information Operations in the U.S. Pacific Fleet. Jim, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, Bill. Great to be with you.
That's it for this podcast. Please tune in again in 2 weeks.
Thanks for listening to Victory Over Communism with award-winning national security journalist Bill Gertz, the only program in the free world unafraid to pull back the curtain of communism to reveal how the Communist Party of China and even America's own brand of Marxism pose real threats to freedom and democracy in America and the world today. See you next time on Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz.